Hello everyone, and welcome to New Books in Art. I'm your host Ricarda, and I'm here today to talk to James Del Borgo about his new book, Collecting the World, The Life and Curiosity of Hans Sloane, published by Penguin in 2017. The book tells the fascinatingly complex and controversial story of Hans Sloane, the man whose collection and last will laid the foundation for the British Museum, the first national, free, public museum. For Del Borgo, Sloane was for far too long an overlooked figure who knitted together the interests of a rising empire through methods of botany, natural history, and medicine. Overshadowed in part by his counterpart Isaac Newton, Sloane's life synchronizes with the changes of 17th century England to 18th century Britain. His life and the time are deeply interwoven with slavery and a new world of commerce. It was thanks to this interconnected world and the many intermediaries that Sloane managed to accumulate so many weird and wonderful objects from different places. He collected, catalogued, and exhibited them according to his own belief system, which centered around binaries of enlightenment versus superstition and sober empiricism versus magic. More than anything, Del Borgo's book reveals the complex lives and stories around Hans Sloane's collection and the many different peoples, places, and stories that are attached to the silent objects, even today. It raises important historical questions about ownership and authorship of public museums, collections, and curatorial practices, and makes them relevant for us today. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Art. I'm your host, Ricarda, and I'm here today to talk to James Del Borgo about his new book, Collecting the World, The Life and Curiosity of Hans Sloane. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you very much, Ricarda.
So before we start talking about your excellent book, would you please tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, my name is James Del Borgo, and I was born in the UK. And started my education in the UK and later continued my studies in the US. I've trained in history, colonial history, and the history of science, in particular in the early modern period, principally the 17th and the 18th centuries. And my early training is in the history of the Atlantic world and colonization in the British colonies of the Atlantic world. In fact, I then went on to study collecting and museum studies. I teach currently at Rutgers University, which is the state university of New Jersey, but I'm often in London and the UK. And working on the Sloane book, of course, for many years, had me working for a long time at the British Library, the British Museum, and the Natural History Museum. So in some ways, I geographically follow the subjects that I study, which means I'm often crossing the Atlantic.
Excellent. Thank you. And so you mentioned a little bit about the book already, but could you tell us how you came to write the life and curiosity of Hans Sloane, Collecting the World?
Absolutely. It's really very simple, which is that when I was teaching a few years ago at McGill University in Montreal in Canada, I was teaching some material on natural history. And I didn't know anything about or anything much about Hans Sloane at the time. But we read some work by a scholar of art history called Diane Criz, who taught at Brown University. And Diane Criz wrote an article about Hans Sloane and his natural history of Jamaica and the visual images of plants and other things that he included in that volume. Now, the thing that really interested me was I never knew that the future founder of the British Museum had been in the West Indies, that he had spent over a year in Jamaica. And for me, this was fascinating and provocative. And I really thought, well, this is very interesting because what then is the connection between Sloane's career and the origins of the British Museum, his great legacy, and slavery and the British Empire as it then was, and the lives and the knowledge of enslaved African men and women. So this was a tremendous intellectual provocation, if you like, a connection that I hadn't known about. And then I really assumed that most people, certainly in the UK, would know a lot about Hans Sloane, that his biography must be boringly well known. I mean, the founder of the British Museum. It was really impossible for me to imagine in the beginning how little most people in the general public really knew about Sloan. And I came to realize that over time. And then I thought, well, it would be worth taking the time to tell this story that is about the history of collecting and the history of colonialism, and produces one of the first great national public museums anywhere in the world. And I specifically thought this would be a topic of interest, not just to scholars, but also the general public. So I determined that I would write the book with Penguin, which I'm very glad I was able to do, as a work, as a very much an interpretation, but also a narrative of this person's life and of his collections, so that the general public could know this story, because I thought it was very important that they do that, since the British Museum is very much a living legacy, and we should understand where it came from and who produced it and exactly how.
So we're going to jump right into the book. And you divided the book actually into two parts. And the first part, called Empire of Curiosities, kind of sets the stage of Sloan's colonial origins and travels, as well as his early career as a physician and his early collecting practices and the kind of origins of all of that. So in chapter one, you vividly describe the complex world of the Restoration in which Sloan is born and raised. And so I was therefore wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the period and has Hans Sloan as a quote-unquote Protestant colonialist in Catholic Ireland.
Yes, indeed. Well, it bears repeating that the founder of the British Museum was born in Ireland, was born in the north of Ireland, born in Ulster in 1660, the year of the Restoration. So first general point to make is on the chronology. Sloan's life really is remarkable in how it synchronizes with the rise of the British Empire between roughly the middle of the 17th and the middle of the 18th century. What we have is a life lived at a very particular point in time. Restoration, 1660. He then goes to, just to jump ahead for a moment, goes to Jamaica in 1687, comes back in 1689, the year of the Glorious Revolution that puts William III on the throne. Looking forward, he publishes his Natural History of Jamaica in 1707, the year of the Act of Union between England and Scotland. And he dies in 1753, and out of his legacy comes the creation of the British Museum, which opens in 1759. 1759 is the year, the so-called Annus Mirabilis, in which the British military forces in South Asia and North America turned the tide against the French, marking the rise of Britain into a global imperial power in a way that it had not been before. And so what we have is chronologically a life that lines up remarkably well with the making of British society, the making of British wealth, the making of London, the rise of colonial finance and wealth from sugar colonies and many other kinds of trading. And so that is a very crucial element to understand where these collections and Sloan's ability to make them came from. The British Isles had been a very divided set of peoples up until the 18th century, not least the Jacobite rebellions, not least the fights between Protestants and Catholics in the Glorious Revolution. So Sloan is able to do what he does because the nature of English and British society is transformed over the arc of his life. He's extremely long-lived. So that's the chronological side. Of course, the geographical side is he is born in Ulster as an Ulster Protestant. He is the son of servants to aristocrats. These aristocrats come from Ayrshire in Scotland, and so do his own parents, who were servants helping these noblemen run their estates. And so Sloan grows up in a very particular place with a very particular history, that is Protestant Ulster, as it is being incorporated into what will then become British life in general in the 18th century. So he's something of an outsider. He is the third son, and that means by the laws of primogeniture that he does not inherit the property that his own father acquires. That goes to the firstborn. And so when Sloane is about 19 years of age in the year 1679, he's ambitious and he needs to make his own way in the world. So he moves to London and he trains as a doctor. And he then embarks on a very lucrative career as a physician. But he is an interesting character because he has both privilege and outsider status. He is born into the Protestant elite in Ulster, and of course they are seizing as much Catholic land and property as they can throughout this period. But this is not something he personally inherits, and so he has to make his way, and that's what he does in London.
In the following two chapters, in chapter 2 and 3, you describe Sloane's journey as a physician to the Duke of Albemarle, to the island of Jamaica, England's soon-to-be most important colony. You describe in really vivid and discomforting detail how much disdain Sloane had for the Afro-American slaves and how Sloane's accounts of the former tie into the English more generally coming to imagine themselves as, quote, Taino allies outraged by Spanish atrocities and therefore thus rationalizing their own colonial efforts as, again, quote, moral counterweight to Iberian barbarity. Now, these are all quotes from page 67. And so I was wondering if you could tell us more about how slavery provided the essential foundation of Sloane's career and how the 15 months he spent at the island of Jamaica lay the foundation not just for his collection practices, but also for his scientific credibility as the author of the 2-volume encyclopedia, Natural History of Jamaica.
Yes, well, as you say, chapters 2 and 3 are essentially set in Jamaica. When Sloane is, at that point, he's about 27 years of age, 1687 to 1689, he becomes physician to the new governor of Jamaica, the Duke of Albemarle, a notorious drunken ne'er-do-well. And who does not last very long in Jamaica. Sloane tries to keep him alive, but it's simply not possible because his master will not give up carousing and not listen to his physicians. So Jamaica is absolutely foundational to Sloane's career, to both his wealth and to his scientific acclaim, his acclamation as a man of letters, a learned a natural historian, and as a physician. So this is a relatively short period, but an absolutely formative one. To zoom out for a second, of course, the background for this is that the English are trying to catch up on other European imperial powers who have been already very successful and brought in a huge amount of money in different ways from colonizing different parts of the Americas. Of course, the Portuguese and the Spanish, originally through various means, through in particular using enslaving indigenous people and enslaving Africans to work in mines, to bring silver and gold as bullion back to Europe, and then actually shipping it over to Asia. Then the Dutch and the French, the Dutch break into the slave trade that the Portuguese had dominated. The French also start to colonize. So the English are late, and the English are worried by Catholic power. And the references you make to some of Sloane's descriptions in Jamaica resonate precisely in this way, that he is extremely self-conscious, in part because, of course, Jamaica had been under Spanish control until 1655. And so when Sloane is actually describing Jamaica, he's often doing so tacitly in a way that will remind readers of his account of his natural history of Jamaica, not only that the English are the current rulers, but they are better rulers, that they somehow have a moral legitimacy. This, of course, despite African slavery, they somehow have a moral legitimacy which the Spanish lacked. So Sloane is often referring back to what is known as the Black Legend, the idea that the Spanish had been the most cruel and barbarous and unchristian of colonizers, making reference to the fact that the indigenous Taino population of Jamaica is thought in large part not merely to have died from disease, but to have committed mass suicide in order to avoid the depredations of the Spaniards. And in fact, Sloane describes in his book a remarkable and disturbing scene of finding human remains in pots in a cave in Jamaica that he takes to be the remains of the indigenous Taino who took their own lives to avoid the brutality of life under the Spanish. Oh, what a shame that they had not known kinder masters, the English. Now, of course, this was a fiction. Of course, this was a way in which the English, perhaps in their own minds, perhaps in the minds of the world at large, tried to legitimate themselves as new colonial masters. Sloane's time in Jamaica is completely immersed in African slavery. And the brutality of this regime is something that he himself describes in a lengthy and graphic passage on the torture and execution of rebel slaves, which he concludes by justifying as necessary for the upkeep of slavery and the profitability of the system, as well as saying that any brutality the English have shown is nothing compared to the slaves themselves or indeed other Europeans. So, two essential facts about Sloane's relationship to the institution of slavery. He's a plantation doctor when he's in Jamaica. That is, he is working for the plantocracy. He is trying to heal both whites and slaves so that slaves can return to work. He tends to trust very much what white colonists, English colonists, tell him about their endless complaints, either real or hypochondriac. And yet when he reviews what he is told by enslaved African men and women about their physical or even psychological distresses, he dismisses this as mere shirking and trying to avoid work. So you could say that the racism that was ingrained in slavery was as ingrained and as institutional in his own disposition as a physician. He did not treat complaints of black and white equally in Jamaica, far from it. So what's very, very important about Jamaica is, first of all, that when Sloane comes back, he marries an heiress to Jamaica sugar and cacao plantations, a woman by the name of Elizabeth Langley Rose. He meets Elizabeth Rose when he's in Jamaica through her husband, Dr. Fulk Rose, a fellow doctor. After Sloane comes back from the island by the 1690s, Fulk Rose has died, and Sloane then in 1695 marries Elizabeth Langley Rose, and by the terms of their will, he gains access to 1/3 of the profits from her plantations. That means he is a direct beneficiary of the institution of slavery, and we see from his surviving account books money in to his accounts in terms of hogsheads of sugar transported from those plantation estates. And in fact, on some of those same pages, you see money paid out for curiosities. This is just one illustration of the fact that money from the institution of slavery fed Sloane's collecting. It is certainly not the only source of income that he had. He probably derived more income from his medical practice, but it was often remarked that Sloane could not have collected in the same way without the fortune made through his wife, Lady Sloane, about whom we unfortunately know very little in the documentary record, but she was pivotal to his career in this respect. Second point to make is that Sloane, as a result of his time in Jamaica, produces a lavishly illustrated natural history of Jamaica. And we know because he says so, we know that he deliberately sought out knowledge about plants and animals and herbal remedies from enslaved Africans. And if you go to this day to the Natural History Museum in South Kensington, if you go to the Sloane Herbarium, which is located in the Darwin Center, you will see volumes of pressed plants that Sloane brought back from Jamaica to London in 1689. They're still there. miraculously and as a testament to their collection and their curation, none of them have been lost. Many of those plants, some of which are African in origin, like okra plants or guinea corn, otherwise known as sorghum, these specimens are still glued to the page, and they would have come from African cultivators in Jamaica, because Sloan visited the provision grounds where slaves even grew their own food. So there is a direct material scientific legacy that is physically present in the Natural History Museum that comes from Afro-Jamaica. And the publication of the Natural History of Jamaica in 1707 and 1725 featured enormous life-size, incredibly meticulous drawings of these plants of interest to botanists around Europe at the time. That volume really established Sloan's credentials as a mighty naturalist who had actually, somewhat unusually, done the traveling himself, been out and collected these specimens with the help of slaves and others, and produced really an encyclopedic work on the colony that, as you rightly say, was becoming the most financially important in all of Britain's empire. So Jamaica is a foundation, slavery is a foundation, both scientifically and also financially for Sloan.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I hope we get to talk a bit more how these collections are still are kind of exhibited today, and whether Hans Sloan's story, the way you tell it, is part of the exhibit. Because in the second part of the book, entitled Assembling the World, you trace Sloan's rise in London after you already said his marriage to the wealthy widow Elizabeth Rose, which really positioned him among London's elite. And then, I think the following chapters are really incredibly revealing in terms of the interconnectivity of a small elite of landed aristocrats and wealthy merchants and traders who really consolidated power amongst them and made landmark decisions, such as the incredibly complex enterprise of establishing a quote-unquote public museum. And as I said, we'll be talking about more about this along the way.
Yes, well, that's very much the case. I mean, when Sloan comes back to London, he becomes precisely one of the figures you mentioned, this relatively small number of people who are professional people, and they have connections, of course, to Parliament. They're really connected to the world of trade. The world of commerce is expanding and bringing a new kind of wealth, not gold or silver, into British coffers, but people who trade in slaves, people who trade in sugar, chocolate, various commodities. This is the world of expansion that distinguishes 18th century Britain from 17th century England, and Sloan is right at the heart of it. He is connected to so many different people. This is really his genius in a way. Sure, he comes home, he becomes a physician, and this is central to his wealth and his position. He becomes one of the wealthiest London society physicians in the first half of the 18th century. And he has many aristocratic clients. He has clients in the royal family. He has clients connected to people like Sir Robert Walpole, the first person to be called Prime Minister. So he is extraordinarily well connected and becomes extremely wealthy as a result of that. But more than that, I think he collects together through himself a set of institutions and institutional friendships that were really foundational to him then being able to go on and create what becomes the British Museum, because he had been connected to so many people. When they had the idea of making his collections into an institution, they had a kind of trust and connection to Sloan. And I think without that, there's a question about whether his legacy would have been executed in the way that he hoped. So, you know, the remarkable thing is how many institutions he connected. He became the secretary and then ultimately the president of the Royal Society. At the same time, he was president of the Royal College of Physicians. And of course, these are elite clubs of leading men, professional men, gentlemen, but they were also completely tied to the world of commerce. The Royal Society was a place where Sloane had introduced many more correspondents traveling the world. Maybe they could furnish new, interesting drugs or observations on foreign peoples. Of course, as Royal College of Physicians president, he was particularly interested to control pharmacopoeia in London. He was very well placed to have the authority to judge whether new drugs from other continents were could be lucrative and useful and dramatically effective, or on the other hand, might be poisonous, dangerous, and so on. He was also extremely closely linked with Chelsea Physic Garden, which is still there in Chelsea, in many ways the forerunner of Kew Gardens as an imperial nursery for plants from many different parts of the world. And this was where Sloane had trained in part after getting to London in 1679. And really, he never forgot his debt to the herbal and botanical training that was at the heart of his medicine and at the heart of his collecting, that went back to Chelsea Physic Garden. So he's a great patron of the garden. He makes sure that travelers who are his personal correspondents will send back seeds for this, if you like, experimental garden to. For example, they are installing greenhouses in the beginning of the early 18th century, or furnaces to do things like grow cacao. Is it possible to grow cacao in the early part of the 18th century? And in fact, it is possible, although they can't make the English cacao trees, maybe that doesn't sound terribly appetizing, bear fruit. They can't actually produce cacao nuts. So there's no homegrown English chocolate at the time. But that tells you, I think wonderfully, speaks of the world in which this man was moving, and that he was as much, if not more than anybody else, animating a world of botanical knowledge, of long-distance bioprospecting, of the attempt to domesticate and to make money out of the domestication of plant stuffs from abroad. So Sloane is this, for far too long, overlooked figure who is knitting together the interests of an empire, a rising empire, through the methods of botany, natural history, and medicine. It's worth pointing out, incidentally, that many of our narratives within the history of science for what was going on in British science in this part of the 18th century were for a very long time had everything to do with Isaac Newton, experimental science, physical science, Newtonianism, and this has always been, or for a long time, was considered really the story. And it's so interesting that it's a story that cleaves the history of science into two without even telling you, because, of course, Sloane was not a physical practitioner of physical science. He did not conduct laboratory experiments. But in a way, there were many more Sloanes than Newtons, which may be a back-added way of praising Newtonian genius, which was always much talked about in the 18th century. But it's to say that at a geographical level and a demographic level, there were many more people involved in what you could call the big science of the 18th century. And that was botany, and that was natural history, and that was collecting, and that was prospecting for information and substances that could turn out to have an extraordinary value. And if you then shift to that world, then the picture of science in the 18th century looks, in a sense, more accurate. It was global. It was certainly imperial. It didn't simply involve a small a caste of elite learned characters. It involved women. It involved enslaved people. It involved indigenous people from many different societies. I mean, these were really the people that Sloane wanted to gain access to in terms of their knowledge about plants and medicines. And how could you do that in India and China and Vietnam and Siam and the Caribbean and Canada? what Sloan then therefore developed was this extraordinary network of travelers. To be sure, most of these were English. They were journeymen in the East India Company or the South Sea Company or the Hudson's Bay Company, or they were planters in places like Antigua or Virginia or Carolina. But the crucial thing that he's doing and the way he is making these vast collections of objects and specimens of man-made things and natural things is through these travelers, and it is these travelers in places like India or the American South who are interacting with indigenous populations, enslaved, displaced populations, trying to learn from them what they know about plants and objects that maybe nobody has seen before in 18th century Europe that could be of extraordinary value. So I think that is really the story that develops, that's really the origins of these collections, and therefore really the origins of the British Museum as a public museum. It was really this empire of connections that wasn't just European. It was all of these different travelers really doing a version of what Sloan himself had, after all, done in Jamaica. He had gone into those provision plantations because he wanted to find what it was that enslaved Africans would know about plants and animals and medicines that Europeans did not.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That was a perfect summary of how to become Hans Sloan in a way, and much more than that.
Yes, exactly.
And much more than that as well. And this is really why I think your book is so important, you know, because it kind of rectifies, as you said, our idea of 18th century science and empire, if you will. And so in chapter four, we're going to go back to Sloan. You further talk about what you call Sloan's, quote, enthusiastic curiosity mongering. That's on page 162. I thought that was quite a curious way of describing his passion for collecting. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that, and maybe exemplify that with, for example, his four-part illustrated essay that describes a China cabinet from 1698 to 99, which I think he published in the Philosophical Transactions, the publication that was done by the Royal Society and the first journal of science, as I understand it.
Well, certainly the first regular scientific publication in the British Isles. But yes, Sloan became the editor of the Royal Society's Philosophical Transactions in 1693, and in many ways it had not been particularly active, and he really made it much more active. And the contrast here that one can usefully mention is with something we've already talked about in part, that the world of Newtonianism and experimental science. So Sloan was a very active editor. He was in touch with many different traveling correspondents, and he was interested in things that were curious, things that were perhaps odd things, perhaps things whose value or meaning weren't yet established. And he undertook it if you like, suspend judgment. This is really the kind of natural history as a speculative endeavor that he's practicing. Let us have a description of a rare plant or a rare bird, and maybe it's something we know about, maybe it's not. Let's have a letter published that describes some odd inscriptions at a cave somewhere in Goa that maybe we don't understand, but this could be interesting. Maybe others will take up further inquiry at some later date. So enthusiastic curiosity mongering. So enthusiastic and speculative, extremely latitudinarian, if you like, willing to let the reach exceed the grasp. Phenomena that we don't completely understand, phenomena that are curious, that might merit further investigation. They might tell us more about foreign peoples, they might tell us more about what they produce and how to produce it in terms of manufacturing. But mongering, well, not everybody was convinced. And we'll come back to that in a second. But the article that you refer to is a multi-part article on, as you say, a China cabinet. What this was, and it still exists in the British Museum, and one can look these things up on the British Museum's website and find pictures of them and some further details of them. This was a set of instruments that belonged to a surgeon. It was picked up by a man called Edward Bulkley, traveling actually around South Asia, and he'd gotten hold of what he identified as a set of Chinese implements for shaving, some razors, some combs, and in particular, two or three implements that caught the attention because they seemed amusing or odd, or it wasn't clear what they were. These were described either as ear ticklers or ear pickers. And in the article that Sloan had published about these is included in the engraving of these of the contents of this surgical case, a picture of a man depicted as a man from China who is in a smiling way using one of these implements to relieve himself of a certain irritating sensation in his ear by using one of these particular tools. The more significant or as significant is that these ear ticklers or ear pickers were picked up on by a satirical writer who absolutely slaughtered Sloan in a satirical attack called The Transactioneer, a reference to Sloan, the peddler of transactions, right? So the monger is significant in that Sloan is a peddler of transactions. He's just a kind of lowly tradesman who's not really very intelligent or very learned. He's certainly no Isaac Newton. He's no genius writing the Principia Mathematica and framing laws of motion. No, these are all odds and ends and unexplained things. And the transactioneer is a very, for the period, typically amusing Swiftian satire in which Sloan is pilloried as a kind of mindless follower of fashion, that anything that comes from Asia must be of interest. And it's written by a man called William King, who the most interesting thing about the satire is that it's very much a Little Englander kind of satire. It's really the idea that these new men interested in commerce, this new elite interested in the wider world and all these exotic things, well, it's just a load of rubbish, isn't it, really? Because, I mean, why do we need to go beyond our shores in order to get things of value? What's wrong with English things or British things? So it's satirical, it's jokey, it's a takedown, but it's also a kind of insular philosophy that anything coming from abroad with strange-sounding names is vaguely ridiculous and ultimately a bit pointless. The final thing to say about all of this is that although that was just a satirical attack by a Grub Street hack, if you like, a satirist, there was, when Sloane became president of the Royal Society in 1727, there is a continuity of this view of him as a kind of lowly dunderhead that extends from this kind of satirical attack in 1700 to some of the grousing about Sloane succeeding Isaac Newton as president of the Royal Society in 1727. There were those for whom this was to bring the Royal Society into a kind of intellectual disrepute because of Sloane's intellect and his natural history being bound up not with the lofty verities of mathematics or causal natural philosophy, but with the grubby, commercial exotica that looked like the sort of things that were pouring into the emporiums of London at the time. Not only this, but there's a class attack on Sloane for bringing apothecaries into the fellowship of the Royal Society. Now, some of these apothecaries were very learned and extremely well-connected to people traveling around the world, and therefore able to get all kinds of rare specimens. Best example here is James Petiver, who was an apothecary in Aldersgate in East London, and Sloane has Petiver made into a Fellow of the Royal Society, which is quite an extraordinary thing to elevate, if you like, somebody who was not wealthy, not a gentleman, let alone an aristocrat, into the company of fellows from that class. So what I think is particularly interesting is the alignment of stars, if you like, between ideas about class, ideas about science, and ideas about geography. All these things were linked in the way in which people did attack Sloane's enthusiastic curiosity mongering. It was, to critics, intellectually lowly and a bit shameful compared to the heights of Newtonian genius. It was introducing lower class tradesmen who, you know, sold medicines for a living in the streets of London, and it was involving the Royal Society and therefore British learning about the natural world much more frankly in the commercial dynamics of global trade, with all kinds of implications, one of which was that at the time there was great concern about the amount of gold and silver that the British, among other Europeans, are paying out to East Asian and South Asian markets for spices, silks, the fashion for chinoiserie, and this kind of thing. So there was almost a kind of moral concern about global trade impurifying and threatening, if you like, not only British intellectual integrity, but financial integrity in terms of the flows of global wealth in this period, despite the rise of the empire. So Sloane is in the center of the Royal Society polemic about these issues of class, style of science, geography. But the point is that they're really much larger issues, and through the kind of natural history that he practiced, we see a very strong reaction against them. Not everybody thought this was speculative, potentially useful, charming. Some people thought it was base, ridiculous, and really beneath contempt.
I'm going to follow up on this, actually, because you who knows Hans Sloane so very well, what do you think? Did he himself actually believe that all the curiosities that he's collecting will continue to be curious for future generations? Because he wasn't all too bothered by all the criticism that you just mentioned, and he simply continued to collect as much as he could. Is at least kind of the picture I get from reading the book. So, do you think he kind of believed in his collecting practices and in the value of these objects?
Well, I think you're right. I think somehow, his wealth insulated him from a lot of these attacks, and his longevity. He was, I think one reason people didn't work on him for many years is because on the page, he's not particularly charismatic. There are many people who say he's excellent company. And, you know, I wish I was ill so the doctor could come round and I could spend an hour with Sloane and this sort of thing. So I think he was very urbane. He was perhaps rather understated in some ways. He was not an interesting lunatic, if you will, like Newton. Newton was a millenarian. He was arguably extremely paranoid. He was a genius. But we now know was a sort of tormented a person who was highly vindictive in philosophical disputes with rivals. Sloane is not that way at all. He is studiedly diplomatic, and so therefore he's a different kind of social character who operates in a different manner from the classic intellectual rival sort of way of looking at such figures. Now he does mention to one of his friends, I think it's probably John Ray, that he is very much stung by the attack that William King makes on him. So there is a record of him saying he did not like this at all, and it bothered him. And in fact, in his Natural History of Jamaica, with a mix of perhaps defensiveness and also imperiousness. He says, you know, there will always be malicious, contemptible persons who peevishly scorn any attempt to innovate intellectually and talk about things that we don't really understand, that come from faraway places whose names and languages we don't understand, and they are to be ignored. And he could ignore them with the money, with the institutional connections he had, with the patronage at his disposal. So I think you're right that he was able to continue, even though he might have been quite perturbed about it. As to the question of whether he thought all his curiosities would ultimately prove valuable, I don't think he's... I think in a sense the answer would be yes, but he's not going to worry about doing that work himself. His time is enormously consumed, after all, by running his medical practice, running the Royal Society, running the Royal College of Physicians, physician to the royal family, correspondence alone, maintaining correspondence with hundreds, if not thousands of people over the course of his life, documenting his collections, writing catalogues, often in his own hand, not always. After a while, he becomes too old and too tired, and he does have many assistants, but he is not in a position to work on the collections. The collections are his work in their own right. Here's one other important thing to say about your question. I think we have to see Sloane's criterion for valuing curiosities as twofold, and there's a very important relation between the two things. One is that he definitely sees himself as a sober, empirical physician and a materialist. Not in a religious sense. He's a rather standard kind of Christian, very moderate, believes in freedom of conscience. But he is somebody who thinks that when you collect a specimen of cacao from Jamaica and you bring it back to London and you put it in your Natural History of Jamaica, what's most interesting about it is the ability to produce chocolate as a medicinal drink, ultimately, and its commodity value. This is commercial natural history. It's utilitarian. It's medical. He does have some ethnographic interest, to be sure. He's very interested in the fact that cacao nuts, as he puts it, pass for money in various different indigenous societies. Now, this is a clue to the second aspect of what could be valuable about a given object, when that value is not material. So cacao sometimes passes for money, that's interesting, but there, beyond that, there are many instances of Sloane collecting objects associated with various forms of magic, or we could say astrology, alchemy, forms of knowledge that were immensely learned and practiced and regarded with great seriousness by learned naturalists and philosophers in Europe, certainly well into the 17th century, but are being increasingly challenged by the 17th and 18th century. And Sloane is one of those people, I think particularly through his exposure to various forms of chemistry as part of his training as a physician and as a botanist, working on ideas of using the chemical manipulations of plants and herbal medicines and so on. Sloane regards anything to do with magic not only as wrong, but he says as insane. It's really a form of error that approximates insanity. And so he's usually very diplomatic, but one of the few times where he is outspoken is recommending particularly strong purges, bloodletting. He's a Galenical healer, after all. For those who seriously believe in the power of astrology or the power of alchemy, the ability to use magic to discover the location of buried treasure, this for him, whether these practitioners are English, whether they are Christians, whether they are Muslims, whether they are Afro-Caribbean healers, for him, this is a form of insanity. And so those objects relating to magic whether these are amulets, talismans, whether these are written charms or prayers. In the British Library, he has an enormous collection to this day of charms or prayers, verbal formulas for protection and healing against evil spirits and other forms of physical and spiritual danger. These things will not have a practical use for Sloane, but they precisely show what not to believe about the natural world. At the same time, the way he collects his plants and documents plants and animals and other things that can be materially useful, these are the two sides, if you like, of the coin. Between the coin, on one side, superstition, on the other side, enlightenment. On the one side, magic, on the other side, sober empiricism. There's only the thing itself. There are no magical powers in words or that inhere in any material object. So these are two different kinds of value. One, utterly commercial, botanical, and so on. The other, cultural, what we would call more ethnographic. It's kind of reverse ethnography. He's not really trying to understand how a given culture works as such in a particular part of the world. It's not modern anthropology, but to use many different objects from many different places to illustrate and to put in his collection, put in his museum, to illustrate and to exhibit the follies of these outdated doctrines, and really to see his collection and the museum ultimately teaching, yes, useful lessons about useful knowledge, practical knowledge of the natural world and how to exploit it as a good commercial Protestant imperialist, but at the same time also to almost have a kind of therapeutic, a cultural therapeutics of the museum, where we display many examples of the errors of many different peoples and civilizations, again, including the kinds of alchemists who had been very authoritative and well-respected, and alchemists in England, even into the 17th century. So this is, in a sense, intellectually where the collections center for Sloane, in this double lesson about practical commodifiable value, but also the value of seeing the errors of various cultures.
Now, in chapter 6, Putting the World in Order, you introduce one of my favorite stories, which is about the West African Muslim slave trader, actually, from Senegal, Ayuba Suleiman Diallo, who was himself enslaved, but later freed, with the help of Sloane and others. Could you tell our listeners more about this anecdote and why you think it important in the context of the story you tell?
Well, Diallo is perhaps the most remarkable story that we have of a relatively well-documented individual who pertains very much to the collections. And it's extraordinary because of the complexity of the encounter. To sum it up, this is a man who is a Muslim. He's from West Africa, from Bundu, Senegal, who in the 1730s is sold into slavery, finds himself in Maryland. According to the story, writes a letter in Arabic, really seeking his freedom. And the story that we have, improbable though it is that this letter finds its way to London and is translated and is read by a British military figure and philanthropist and founder of Georgia, General James Oglethorpe, who was a friend of Sloane's. And by one means or another, a group of philanthropically minded Londoners, among whom Sloane counts himself, arranges for Diallo to be brought to London, and he is. And when he is in London, one of the things he does is to stay with Sloane in his house in Bloomsbury, where he translates the Arabic on a number of Persian amulets, these charms, in fact, that I just mentioned. They're an example of this. Very few people, of course, at this time in early 18th century London have command of Arabic. So this is a remarkable opportunity for Sloane. And the Quranic inscriptions on these amulets are part of that sort of culture of prayer and healing and so on. These amulets, by the way, are still in the British Museum. They're extraordinarily beautiful objects. One of the reasons Sloane may have valued them as physical things, even if he did not value them other than in the negative as illustrations of misguided belief. And if you like, I mean, don't forget, he's a doctor through it all. Here's how, here's an example of erroneous medicine or folk belief that Sloane, of course, just by his very professional being, is against. So, of course, it's a remarkable episode in the history of knowledge and learning and what we might say intellectual orientalism and antiquarianism and so on and so forth. But what I'm looking to do throughout the book, and Diallo is such a good case of it, is absolutely to tell that intellectual history story, but also to realize that that exchange of knowledge takes place within a dynamic between different people. And of course, when Diallo is doing this work, he is still waiting to be freed. He has not yet been manumitted. And of course, I think the right way to see what is going on is as a set of negotiations, exchanges, relationships that are intellectually productive for somebody like Sloane. But of course, this is all somehow to negotiate Diallo's possible release. And in fact, he is finally set free and returned as remarkably as an agent of the Royal African Company in West Africa, in theory, to collaborate with the British against their French rivals. The French are in West Africa. Of course, West Africa is valuable not only for the slave trade, but for gum trading and gold mining and things like this. And so the story is remarkable, not just given the combination of intellectual history and the personal history and the dynamics involved in an individual negotiating and navigating their way back from slavery to freedom. But of course, I think it's tells us something very important about Sloane himself, which is that it is very unwise to look for modern day heroes and villains in any kind of obvious and crude way when looking at the people in this story. I mean, after all, Diallo goes back as a slave trader. And of course, you know, Sloane himself is somebody whose legacy is a remarkable public legacy. But we know that the foundations are not only through the rise of the British Empire generally, but very specifically, of course, in Jamaica and through the institution of slavery. So the book is really written to keep these two stories together at the same time and to try to put them in relation rather than to somehow cast a judgment from today about whether this man is a hero or whether he is a villain. These terms don't fit our understanding very well. And I think Diallo is a magnificent case where this issue also comes up because years ago, his portrait done by a man named William Hoare in the early 1730s, which had been at the National Portrait Gallery, was in London, was in the process of being secured for the Qatar Museums Authority in Qatar. And a debate took place in the press about Diallo, and it's something that happens with Sloane a lot, which is the complicating factors are edited out of the story. Now, this is entirely reasonable or predictable, if you like, in terms of contemporary politics. Is this person a villain or a slave? How can we make an argument for him one way or the other? It's, of course, very bad history. And it strips away the complexity of a person like Diallo. And indeed, I think with Sloane, what was often the case was to say, especially in the UK, well, he's a magnificently important figure and is a museological hero and so on. Yes, indeed, I think that is quite true. But I don't think you can say that without understanding the background in slavery and imperialism. I think the perception is often that, well, which are you saying then? Is it the one or the other? And of course, that cannot do any kind of justice to the complexity of the history. I think if there is a lesson that the book tries to share, it is the impossibility of reducing such figures to that kind of choice. And certainly putting these things in relation and understanding where the British Museum comes from in its totality, I think extremely important. And I think does play, I think you can get the complicated history right in a way that actually does serve the civic function of a museum in the present by precisely acknowledging the complexity of where our great public institutions come from. I think that has enormous civic value, and I would like to see museums, including the British Museum, do more of that.
Wow, definitely. I agree with you entirely. And I think you do all of the, you do all of this really well in your book. And just to add on for our listeners, the yellow portrait was actually kept in England then, because I went to see it at the National Portrait Gallery just before doing this interview. And it's still there for anyone to see.
Well, that's an interesting point. My understanding is that it's on a very, very long loan, that it was acquired by the Qatar Museums Authority. But what are we, February 2018? I don't know if that has changed, but I know that for years it remained in London on loan. I don't actually know if that remains the case. Perhaps the terms of the loan have been extended.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Okay. So it's a kind of compromise that you found.
Yes, it's and it's a very, of course, it's a very interesting reversal of the flows of objects and their directions from the only from the early modern period, where, of course, if we're in Europe or even in the United States, we tend to see this period precisely in Sloanian terms. This is the period where things from the so-called East went to the West. I'm sure Chinese historians of China in the long 18th century would rightly see that differently. But it is a very interesting, at least on Diallo's particular story and the story of this portrait, which Sloane may have had a hand in commissioning and in a sense discussing the composition of it, though we don't know the details. It's interesting that this portrait in the present day, given where the world economy is today, both with respect to Middle Eastern nations and the UK. It's interesting, the change of direction, at least in this particular portrait.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. So yeah, before we go on, I really want to emphasize for our listeners that the next two chapters are especially a must read for anybody interested in museology and the complex issues around it. And I think provenance, you know, is also one thing we've not really talked about yet, but we might do in a bit. And then, so basically everything, all the complex issues that come with museology, from collection management and cataloging, labeling, annotating and curating and so on and so forth, to broader questions as well around what a public museum actually means, and who holds ownership and authorship and who gets a voice in all of this. And so I was wondering if you could tell us in more detail about Sloane's attempt to a, quote, total information architecture, as you call it.
This is all very low tech from our point of view. The remarkable thing about Sloane that makes my book possible in some ways is the survival of catalogs. About 50 or so originally, about 30 or so survived. These are thousands of pages of thousands of items, laboriously handwritten. They're not particularly orderly or taxonomic. They're orderly in the sense of they're more or less accession lists, 1, 2, 3, through, in one case, a seed collection through 12,000. Sloane wrote many of those himself. And he did, at least in some of these catalogs, do some cross-referencing. But let's put it this way, it was a dream of total information that couldn't be realized. I don't think it's entirely inappropriate to see this or unuseful to see this in relation to digital technology today. There is a project in London based at the British Museum, also at the BL and the NHM, to digitally reintegrate and make searchable as an integrated set of catalogs across subject areas, the Sloane catalogs. So that's a very interesting update, if you like. And what it tells us historically is that this is a very rare thing that we have an early 18th century collection that is this well documented. These are catalogs on fossil, broken down by simple categories, fossils, birds, fish, plants, vegetable substances, meaning seeds and resins, and antiquities. And then, interestingly, there are some catalogs that don't fit very well. There's one called miscellanies or miscellaneous things. In fact, this was about 2,000 objects that were what we would call largely ethnographic curiosities. But the point is that these acts of inscription, of cataloging, of minute enumeration, this was really at the heart of Sloane's life's work. I mean, this documentation was essential. He took a lot of material from letters that other people wrote and incorporated them into the catalog. So there are many different voices and sources of, for example, stories told about the healing properties of certain West African plants that the Duke of Chandos, associated with the Royal Africa Company, had Sloane sent from Guinea. So a lot of these catalogs remain to be investigated by historians in greater depth. But they were also part of a labeling system whereby Sloane put a number basically to every single thing in all of his catalogs. And these were usually also spatial finding places. They were, you know, a number meant a place on a shelf or in a certain room and so on. So you could have some findability that way. But this, to address the other part of your question, is of course not the same as provenance as such. Sloane certainly did like noting and telling people that a particular object had an illustrious pedigree. This was, for example, an eagle scalp that he had gotten from the leader of the Yamacraw delegation, Tomochichi, who was negotiating the settlement of Georgia and its boundary with the Yamacraw in London, 1733 to 1734. He doesn't actually say how it was acquired. It came from Tomochichi. Doesn't say how he got it. Similarly, in the Natural History of Jamaica, Sloane remarkably has written down and includes in that book music played by slaves and has drawings of instruments, musical instruments, banjos, played by enslaved Africans in Jamaica. Does he tell us how he got those instruments? No. And this is very often the case. And it's the difference between a story that has an association with an illustrious or interesting, exotic, or high-status royal aristocratic person. That's one thing. How does Sloane actually acquire these things? Well, the answer is usually money. But of course, he's buying things secondhand from other people, say in India or Asia, who've already taken them. So there's mysteries. It's the interesting paradox. So much documentation, so voluble about so many aspects of these things and their uses, so quiet on the means of acquisition. Reason for that is that Sloane probably didn't care. There's certainly not a legal issue at the time, or indeed a moral one. We don't know most of the time, but the short and unsatisfying answer is that Sloane paid for many of these objects from intermediaries, other travelers who'd already acquired them by some fashion.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on this, but maybe we'll do this at the very end. Kind of, I'm wondering about whether you think museums today should reveal this kind of provenance that's not given, you know, the provenance that's not provided by Hans Sloane, but by kind of telling the story of Hans Sloane himself, for example.
Well, let me just follow up right away, because there's something specifically worth saying, which is that I think museums have evolved a lot, some more than others, but there is an enormous variety of approach these days. Nevertheless, it's historically accurate to say that the European museum and those museums in other parts of the world that came out of that tradition have always had originally a kind of view from nowhere approach. The view, the, what the museum shows you is a place or a people or a landscape or an animal. And if you like, there's just something very classic about that that resonates with the history of science, the view of science as a view from nowhere. It doesn't matter who's doing the looking, the depicting, the collecting. Their aim is to objectively present an external reality. Now, that is, of course, an important idea that continues to resonate and inform you know, many different areas of intellectual inquiry. But one thing one can certainly say is that I do think museums can dramatically enrich what they present to the public by telling stories about provenance, about acquisition. That is to say that our collections are, of course, relational, as many museum studies scholars have argued. One doesn't have to argue that they show us nothing about other people. One doesn't have to argue that as a corollary of showing who it is doing the knowing and the collecting. Rather, there is a relationship to be made evident between people who did collecting, people who assembled museum exhibits, and the subject matter, whether human or non-human, that they gathered information from, very often without acknowledging it. Take the example of Diallo. I don't think if you go into the British Museum today, you learn anything about him. You might see amulets. I don't know if they've been on display lately. You might see those kinds of objects, and they would classically be presented as here is evidence of a particular culture, of a particular way of doing medicine, and so on. I think just on sheer intellectual interest, and not just for scholars, but for the general public, to see those things and to know the Diallo story, which of course is a curatorial challenge. You know, museums aren't books. They are spaces that combine things, objects, captions, and so on. So it's a curatorial challenge. But I do think there is a very important civic function that actually dynamizes the museum that much more for the general public and involves the public, I think, in a more personal but also intellectually stimulating way. In other words, it's not a choice, in my view, between either we're presenting the objects and we let the objects speak, or we are presenting so much context that the museum viewer cannot really understand things for themselves. I think both things can be done, although I think it's certainly a challenge for curators to do that. So yes, I would very much like to see, especially the larger museums with these kinds of collections, follow the lead of some of the smaller museums who have been very good in showing these museums as places of relationship. And that doesn't mean they're not places of knowledge as well.
We're going to continue with Chapter 7, Creating the Public's Museum. And it's really here that you explain how Sloane's personal museum of curiosities became the entire nation's. And so I would like you to talk a bit more about how it was, in fact, the creation of the British Museum and not any other public institution that first intensified a political debate about the public and their status, and ultimately resulted in the creation of the first public museum, as just said, albeit the fact that some felt more welcome than others. And also, of course, what role Sloane played in this process, even posthumously.
So the public museum is indeed a big idea. And the thing to say about it is, well, you know, one can say that the British Museum is the first national public free museum in the world and an encyclopedic museum at that. So it is distinctive in that. Now, I'm not particularly worried about the fact that it is something new, but it certainly does not exist in a vacuum. And it really, what one means by public, what one means by museum, is the question there. And that is subject to variation. And this could be, for example, some of even the commercial curiosity shops in London in the 18th century, where people had to, yes, they would pay money, but there were all kinds of genuine rarities on display if you went to the coffee shop. So that, in a way, it was a kind of public exhibition space. Of course, if you go back to 17th century Italy, places like Florence, Bologna, and Rome into the 18th century with the Capitolino Museum, you certainly have already a tradition of museums in public buildings. So a kind of public, really almost a kind of literally an architectural sense of this is a public place. So again, how does one see this question of the public? Now, to be sure, what is distinctive in the British case is a particular language in Sloane's will of free universal access for the use of all people. Again, people after him will debate that. Who does this really mean? Curators worry about that. Sloane was not. He was dead. That was going to be other people's problem. So Sloane, in his will and transferring over to the language of the first British Museum Act, this is a museum to be freely available, no charge, to many different kinds of people without theoretically any limit and for use. Okay. So I think the thing to add to all of this, which, as your question suggests, comes later and in a broader public discussion, is what kind of culture of public museum going actually emerges in any given time or place. You know, we can look at the letter of the law, we can look at public associations, civic buildings, and so on, and say, well, yes, there are precursors and there are sort of quasi-public buildings, museums and institutions in various places in Europe and so on that are coming into being earlier. But what I noticed from the Sloane story was something that wasn't Sloane's language or the language of the British Museum Act. It was later in the 1750s, 60s, 70s, 80s, in the period of the American Revolution, when there is great talk about natural rights, of course, an enormous consequential debate about whether the American colonists enjoyed natural rights, universal rights that allowed them to question legislation from Parliament. What's so interesting is that the language of rights is apparent when foreign travelers come, Europeans come, some German visitors in 1770s, 1780s, they're using this language in relation to the museum. So I think what may be more meaningfully distinctive about the British Museum is the actual history of museum going and the expectation in the 18th century that it then became connected to a language of rights. And I'm not sure that would be the case in other contexts. For example, my colleague at UC Santa Barbara, Carol Paul, who has done wonderful work on the origins of public art museums, broadly understood, has written an excellent study of the Capitolino in Rome, emerging in the 1730s as a kind of public museum. I wonder if it's also the case in 18th century Rome. It certainly is the case, I think, in 18th century London, because of these political debates of rights, that this language does come to connect to the British Museum in a way that Sloane certainly did not use that kind of language. And therefore, whether there wasn't a kind of character of museum going that was more robustly public because of that debate, and perhaps to do with the nature of British society, London society in the 18th century, that breathed a kind of life into that ideal that was different from the other previous examples of public museums. Of course, it must be noted that it's really the 19th century when British museum visitorship expands very dramatically. So, you know, this is a story that has to be traced forward. How did this all come about? Well, to answer your other question, Sloan had been very careful in his will to stipulate that if Parliament did not pay the £20,000 he requested for the collections, then the collections would be sent abroad and be kept together. I mean, he wanted the collections kept together. And I think very genuinely, if it were, you know, had it been necessary to send them abroad to keep them together, he would have done it. So he thought about the Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg, the Academy of Sciences in Paris, the Academy in Berlin, the Academy in Madrid. These were all places where he basically threatened Parliament, if you don't take these collections, they will go to these other repositories. But, you know, it didn't happen. It could have happened, but it didn't happen because I think he was so connected. Coming back to this idea of Sloane as somebody who collected people as much as he collected things. He knew a lot of Whig MPs. He had great ties to the Whig establishment. When Parliament is debating in 1753 what to do with his collections, whether to buy them, he has enough friends in place so that he is not cold calling. He is a known quantity. Yes, there are still people who make fun of him. Still, at this point, but he is able to posthumously secure the creation of a new institution to house his collections, I think in part because in some strange way, he was still around. His presence was still animating the debate about these collections. So he had enough allies and friends in order to win that particular day.
Thank you. That was wonderful. And even though he succeeded shortly after his death, his collections now are scattered over quite a few different museums in London, and even, I think, elsewhere in the UK. And so this kind of leads me to my final question, because you talk about this both in the introduction and conclusion, which is sort of, you know, this great Sloane collection, the collector of other collections, ultimately gets swallowed up by the public institution he had asked for. And so his legacy almost fell into oblivion until you decided to write this book, fortunately. But to me, you seem to also kind of make an institutional critique, if you will, whereby you seem to argue, and correct me if I'm wrong, that today's division into specialized fields means that meant in the past breaking up Sloane's collection, which, as I said, was never really studied in its entirety. But going forward, I'm wondering whether you then pledge for less compartmentalized study of social sciences and humanities and instead a more kind of holistic world history of world art and so on and so forth.
Ricarda, I believe strongly in less compartmentalization in pretty much every area of intellectual inquiry, if not in life. I actually have come to be persuaded of the value of that it is highly undervalued, and that specialization, which is not going anywhere and which is the foundation of my own work, is perhaps overvalued as well, in the sense that if we are so specialized, whether as scholars who work in the academy or as curators who work in museums, then we really stop our ability to see other important larger patterns. And I do confess that working on Sloane took me to this perception. First of all, let me say that there are many curators in the London collections who have done tremendous, over many years, tremendous work on Sloane and the collections. And their, without their work, the book would not have been possible. And it was really a pleasure for many years to work with botanists at the Natural History Museum, a tremendous pleasure to work with librarians at the British Library and curators at the British Museum. It was part of the joy. I mean, I did realize how rarely such specialists were speaking to them, to each other, about Sloan in particular, but I think it's more generally true. Now, of course, specialization is a sociological fact, but I am a believer that the Sloan story is ultimately one that can't be told by a specialist. So that became the challenge. That's why the book took 15 years to write and research from start to finish. And therefore, you know, it's not something that could have been done as a short-term specialized project. But we need to know about the way in which somebody who goes to Jamaica in the 1680s is related to an astonishingly important legacy in the 1750s. You know, it's very often been the case that the role of the slaves will be left out of the roll call of what makes Sloan a great figure. So, you know, Sloan has been there in the background because, as you say, these collections were divided up. The great irony of his achievement in getting that museum created was that in the 19th century, when knowledge became more specialized, the collections were divided up by department and by institution. So in a way, he became invisible, or certainly in the integrity of his collections and that vision of how they came together became invisible. And his form of encyclopedism is not our form. You know, if one thinks of the British Museum today or similar institutions like the Metropolitan Museum in New York or Getty or the Art Institute of Chicago, I mean, they've gone in the direction since the 19th century, of course, of archaeology and history of civilization. That is not what Sloan, the doctor and the naturalist, was doing. So in a way, that's the ontological answer to that question. What he tried to do now looks insane. And in fact, as a scholar or as a curator, probably, if you embarked on that breadth of project, you would today probably be considered insane, at least sort of sociologically insane. Why are you doing that? How can you possibly hope to do that? So that's kind of an ironic sociological fact of our time. Of course, the other answer to the question of why Sloan became not entirely invisible, but hardly talked about, I do think is because of the understandable but regrettable taciturnity and silence over the issue of slavery. I think slavery, race, empire have become in some ways harder to talk about in UK society today. In some ways, they're much talked about. But Sloan is, again, what's interesting about him is he's such a mainstream figure. You know, when I became interested in him, I became interested that he was in Jamaica. Jamaica was a fascinating place to study. And I then realized that it was a story taking me back to London and taking me into the foundations of the British Museum. So I do hope the book presents the story in a way that breaks down all kinds of specialized compartments. It shouldn't just be a story for experts in the history of the African diaspora or the Caribbean or empire. Conversely, it shouldn't just be the story of museology, the history of science and medicine. These specializations we are all trained in, they're all ways of helping us make sense of the chaos of the heterogeneous jumble of things as they are, and they're very useful and effective. What I tried to do with the book was to have the benefit of those different approaches, but you're right to say and to really affirm the idea that that kind of sociological division of we should tell stories just in our particular neck of the woods, I think we lose something that is intellectually dynamic and also civically important if we do not try sometimes to make this different breadth of argument and breadth of narrative. So, you know, this is what the book tries to share and give to readers of all kinds. And I certainly have derived, in a way I did not expect, inspiration in terms of this kind of breaking of the compartments, as you describe it. And I hope readers also get the sense that while it is forbidding and one has to take all the specialization seriously and to do our research as carefully as possible, a spirit of intellectual breadth and connection may be the most valuable thing of all.
Excellent. Thank you so much. These were wonderful final words, I think. So I thank you very, very much for your valuable insight and for your time, James, and for writing this hugely fascinating book, Collecting the World, the Life and Curiosity of Hans Sloane. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ricardo. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.